Coming up on Philosophy Talk.
Something terrible has happened.
What should we do with the canon of so-called great books?
All of the kingdom's great books have disappeared.
They've simply vanished. Poof!
Books from the past often contain old-fashioned attitudes about race and gender.
Why should we still be reading them?
Those books contain all the lore and knowledge of our people.
And all the great scientific discoveries and inventions.
And the wonderful stories.
If we only read morally perfect books, how many would we be left with?
How will we live without the great books?
Very poorly, I fear.
I smell an evil plot.
Isn't it dangerous to venerate books from the discredited moral past?
Aren't there some books everyone should read?
Aren't there some books no one should read anymore?
Our guest is Julie Napolin, author of The Fact of Resonance.
Reading The Troubled Path.
Coming up on Philosophy Talk.
Hey, philosopher, thanks for downloading this episode of Philosophy Talk.
And thanks so much for being our partner. You've supported us in the past, and we're really grateful for that support. But we need your help now more than ever.
So here's what you do. Go to our website, philosophytalk.org, click the donate button, and help us make more of what we know you love.
Thank you for listening.
And thank you for thinking.
And thank you for donating.
What's so great about the so-called great books?
Aren't they full of discredited attitudes about race, gender, and sexuality?
Should we even bother to read them anymore?
Welcome to Philosophy Talk, the program that questions everything.
Except your intelligence. I'm Josh Landy.
And I'm Ken Taylor. We're coming to you from the studios of KALW San Francisco.
Continuing conversations that begin at Philosopher's Corner on the Stanford campus, where Ken teaches philosophy and I direct the Philosophy and Literature Initiative.
Today, we're reading The Troubled Past.
You know what, Ken? That past really is full of trouble, and I'm not sure we should be reading it anymore. I mean, take Aristotle. Take Aristotle. He said some people are born to be slaves. I mean, that's not just a bad argument. That's a dangerous argument, and it licensed cruelty for centuries.
Well, Josh, okay, but there's way more than that in Aristotle. And there's way more than Aristotle in the canon. Come on, you can't be suggesting that we should junk the whole canon because of one bad argument in one philosophy book.
Well, it isn't just one bad argument. I mean, Rousseau talked about the so-called noble savage. You know, Horace denigrated women left and right. Dante sent gay men to hell. I mean, the more you read, the more the West starts to look like a history of prejudice, and its books are just like a justification for it.
Oh, God, you're way overgeneralizing here, Josh. I mean, think about, I don't know, Marx, or Simone de Beauvoir, or Du Bois, or Descartes, or Galileo. Come on. The Western canon's full of people who called for liberation. Liberations of blacks, of women, of the poor. Liberation from the church and the king and patriarchy. Gosh, Josh, so many people in the canon, they weren't defending the powers that be. They were attacking them.
Oh, some of those folks talked a good game, Ken, but did they really believe what they were saying? Thomas Jefferson saying all men are created equal while being a slave owner? I mean, the Western canon, Ken, it's nothing but an apologia for oppression, plus, yeah, a few fig leaves.
Nothing but that? Oh, come on, you can't really believe that.
Well, you've got to admit, Ken, way too many of these authors clearly believed that straight white males are superior to everybody else.
Well, there are the Greeks who are an exception, right?
Okay.
Okay. And besides, the authors, all these authors, they don't agree on anything. I mean, take Mill, he celebrated democracy. But Plato despised it. Adam Smith loved capitalism. Jean-Paul Sartre hated it. Look, you can't read the canon as a set of, like, fixed answers. It's a set of questions.
Well, okay, but who gets to decide what those questions are? I mean, not women, not people of color, not colonized subjects.
You're talking about the way it used to be.
Oh, until, like, 10 minutes ago?
Well, you have to admit, we have expanded the canon. Okay, I admit belatedly. I mean, W. E. Du Bois, Toni Morrison, Asha Jabbar, Chinua Achebe. None of them were in the canon when I was a great bookie back at Notre Dame. But they're all in there now.
Okay, so why don't we just forget all the morally compromised dead white guys? I mean, there's plenty of great writing by modern voices, all that stuff you just mentioned. And it doesn't that come with all the oppressive baggage. So let's just read that.
Wait, Josh, come on. You can't be such a triumphal presentist that you think there's nothing to learn from reading the troubled past as troubled as it is. We still have stuff to learn. You're not really saying that nobody should ever read Aristotle's Ethics ever again?
Well, you can read it if you like. I'm just saying we have to stop venerating it as a so-called great book. I think it's time to ditch the very idea of a canon.
No, I don't agree. We shouldn't ditch the canon. We shouldn't ditch the idea of the canon. We just need to expand the canon and our idea of it. And you know what we also need to do? We need to learn how to read it. You don't read it for the fixed answers it delivers, but for the questions it raises.
Well, I still have plenty of questions, Canon, and that's why we sent our roving philosophical reporter, Holly J. McDeed, to investigate what happens when great art turns out to have been made by terrible people. She files this report.
When I was a freshman in college, I fell in love with author Kurt Vonnegut, especially the book Slaughterhouse-Five. It's an anti-war novel about time travel and fate. I could relate to everything he wrote about feeling like a machine. It felt like somehow this bitter, middle-aged war veteran understood me.
Billy is spastic in time, has no control over where he is going next, and the trips aren't necessarily fun. He's in a constant state of stage fright.
But I also noticed a lot of Vonnegut's work is filled with sexist and misogynistic tropes. His short story, Welcome to the Monkey House, describes rape as deflowering. Many of his female characters are freakishly one-dimensional.
She was a dull person, but a sensational invitation to make babies. Men looked at her and wanted to fill her up with babies right away.
You could argue this is all a clever satire meant to critique sexism. After all, Vonnegut writes beautifully about the importance of kindness. But if you read about Vonnegut's life, you'd be forced to grapple with a masterful writer who was also an angry person who could be cruel to his wife and emotionally abusive.
Most art is made by and for men.
Carol Hay is a professor of philosophy at UMass Lowell. She says the debate over what to do with work that degrades and objectifies is not new, but the Me Too movement has given it a new spin.
For a very long time, right, we haven't really bothered asking how artwork about women actually affects women.
Hay says that for centuries, female writers have had their work discredited solely because of their gender. Women are conditioned since childhood to relate to male protagonists and enjoy sexist literature.
When we talk about what it is to be human, we are often sort of smuggling in these implicit assumptions that what we really, like the person that we think of as a sort of generic human is almost always implicitly gendered male.
But it's not just Vonnegut whose life and writing are problematic. Charles Dickens, he gets occasional flack for his vapid female characters. And he also attempted to have his wife committed to an insane asylum so he could marry someone else. Ezra Pound and Richard Wagner, raging anti-Semites.
Given how racist, how sexist we are, how homophobic, how transphobic, right? All of these things, right? Of course that stuff's going to show up in our art.
But does that mean we shouldn't read Vonnegut or we shouldn't teach Dickens in school? Mary Beth Willard teaches philosophy at Weber State University. She says the real question we should be asking is, what do we do with work by artists who are bad people? She's still grappling with what to do with Michael Jackson's music.
I grew up listening to his music, and I'm not that old, but my parents had Thriller on vinyl, and I think I wore that thing out. So there's a sense in which music sort of forms the soundtrack of your life. Then you find out Jackson seems to have been a pretty horrible person.
In the documentary Leaving Neverland, two men accuse the King of Pop of sexually abusing them as children. Jackson has faced allegations of child molestation for decades.
He told me if they ever found out what we were doing, he and I would go to jail for the rest of our lives.
Willard says it can be hard to separate Jackson, the musician who changed pop music forever, with Jackson, the alleged monster.
Should I let my 3-year-old dance to Billie Jean? Should I introduce my 6-year-old to those songs to say, hey, this is how good pop music sounds. This is something you should know how to moonwalk. You're an American child.
Willard says these questions also depend on whether the artist is alive or not. Boycotts don't work so well for people who are dead. And some artists' work is ingrained in our culture and inescapable. Willard's advice, consume their work if you still find it meaningful. But don't forget about the harm these artists caused.
We have a tendency as human beings to idolize those people whose music or artwork or sports prowess we admire. But we really should resist that, because somebody can be a great musician and a horrible human being. And I think that that's, you know, is the lesson that the kids are going to have to get.
After all, if we tossed all the work from all the problematic artists who ever existed in the trash, we'd have nothing left. And so it goes. For Philosophy Talk, I'm Holly J. McDeed.
Thanks for that tour of great art by troubled artists. I'm Ken Taylor. With me is my Stanford colleague, Josh Landy. And today, we're reading The Troubled Past.
We're joined now by Julie Napolin, professor of digital humanities and author of a forthcoming book titled The Fact of Resonance, Modernist Acoustics and Narrative Form. She also happens to be a former roving philosophical reporter on this very show. Julie, welcome back to Philosophy Talk.
Hey, guys. Thanks for having me.
So, Julie, thanks for coming back. I missed those days. You were our rock rhetorician radio personality. So tell me.
It's still those days.
Yeah. So, Julie, tell me, what first got you interested in question of the canon and reading The Troubled Past? Was there something that you read that, troubled you, perhaps?
Yeah, I really came at this question through the work of Joseph Conrad and also someone like William Faulkner. And I came to literature as someone who was working in sound and music and listening. And a book like Conrad's Heart of Darkness was filled with voices and sounds and was this canonical text. But I realized that if I wanted to think about what was so interesting about that text at this level of its sounds and its voices, I would have to contend with its psychology of racism and how Conrad and someone like Faulkner is using sound and voice precisely to unpack the psychology of racism.
That's really interesting. I mean, that brings me to a question about the conversation Ken and I were having at the beginning. You know, should we keep reading these folks? I mean, you're still reading and writing about and teaching people like Conrad and Faulkner, I take it. So it seems like you think it's kind of okay. But do you ever have a moment where you wonder, gee, should we maybe stop reading them and read some other people instead?
Yeah, absolutely. For whatever reason, these are the texts that I keep coming back to, and I'm not alone in doing that. People have been coming back to them for decades. But there have been moments, sometimes in the classroom and sometimes reading essays by others. I read Chinua Achebe's essay on Conrad, and he says, "Conrad is a bloody racist." This is a famous quotation right from Achebe's essay. And that really gave me pause. But I came out of that thinking that rather than not reading, we should read more, read better, and read alongside of other texts.
Yeah, we'll get to the read more and read better. But I want to ask you, though, I mean, why read Conrad? Why in the face of Achebe's bloody racist accusation? I mean, students, I don't teach Conrad to students, but I bet you if I tried to teach Conrad to certain students at Stanford, they'd be bloody up in arms. What would you say to those students who are bloody up in arms about you teaching this text that they would think embodies a racist attitude?
Yeah, well, and I've experienced that before, and one of the things that I keep coming back to is that Conrad was someone who was a historian of empire, and that our present of imperialism and globalization didn't come out of nowhere. And he was someone who was writing really at the beginnings of what we now understand as globalization. And my explanation is that if we want to understand the present, we have to have the history of the present. And Conrad is a part of that. His novel was a kind of record of that transformation.
And it's not just a novel that's racist, even if it has some racist elements. It's also a powerful critique of the Belgian colonial project. I mean, doesn't it present that project as bloodthirsty, cruel, exploitative, and everything else?
Absolutely. But my response is usually that the novel is a racist critique of racism.
Right.
That, you know, Conrad doesn't present Africans as having self-determination, but he does present empire as this delusion, as this radical deception. So how do we hold those two things together, that he fails in some ways to imagine Africans, in many ways fails, but that he also saw through colonialism and saw through the ruse of empire.
Well, I think that's a deep question, and it's the kind of question we want to dig into more, because many texts have this same kind of flaw that you're pointing out. You're listening to Philosophy Talk. Today, we're reading The Troubled Past with Julie Napolin, author of The Fact of Resonance.
How should we approach books from our troubled past? Should we read them as repositories of wisdom, or should we challenge them, contextualize them, and try to sort out the good from the bad?
Parsing the Perilous Past, plus your calls and emails when Philosophy Talk continues. Do the words of 13th century poets still ring true, or are they too full of outdated attitudes? I'm Ken Taylor. This is Philosophy Talk, the program that questions everything.
Except your intelligence. I'm Josh Landy, and today we're reading The Troubled Past. Our guest is Julie Napolin, author of The Fact of Resonance, Modernist Acoustics and Narrative Form.
Julie, it sounded like, okay, I think you and Josh and I agree that we should continue to read these fraught old books. But I think you were raising a question about how we should read them. I mean, so let's dig into this. Are there better and worse ways of going about the reading of these fraught old books?
Sure. And I think I've gone through both good ways and bad ways myself as a teacher. And I've learned that in teaching a really fraught text like Heart of Darkness, if you just throw the text at the students without any contextualization, it's very dangerous and in certain moments really hurtful for a lot of student readers. So I think contextualization is one of the best ways to approach a fraught text like
this. I want to explore that thought a little bit more because I don't know. I think I agree with you, but I'm not sure because I do think students – so look, here's the thing. Students think lots of things are – I'll tell you an experience I had. I teach W. E. Du Bois, The Souls of Black Folks, to freshmen. I once had a freshman tell me – I'm not sure I can quite say exactly what he said on the radio, but I'll paraphrase what he said. She said on the radio. She said, W. E. Du Bois is just another colonized Negro, right? Because the way he describes black people, the freed blacks in the postbellum South, is as dazed – not knowing what to do with their freedom. They fall into criminality and they're not industrious. And these are all the complaints of the white Southerners about blacks. And he seems to be validating them. And she said, he's just another colonized Negro. And I think that student wasn't really reading this text, right? So there is a danger there that students will misread it. But tell me, how would contextualization have helped? Could contextualization have helped get the student beyond that? Because in a way, she was right, that Du Bois thought black people had a kind of diminished consciousness. And it wasn't because they were intrinsically at fault. It's because consciousness was shaped by the social world.
Well, I think with a writer like Du Bois, we're thinking about a really long trajectory where what he's writing in 1903 is not the same as what he's writing in the 40s.
True.
And a text like The Souls of Black Folk, too, is really a document of, as you say, a transformation in a consciousness. And he takes himself as documenting certain moments along the pathway of consciousness. And I think that some contextualization would help with an author like that because looking at the failure of Reconstruction, the failure of the promise of emancipation, in that moment, how that must have felt psychologically to bring that to representation, I think that would be something really important to discuss.
I agree. I mean, so I think a couple of things. So first, look, if you contextualize, if you can explain to the students, look, this was the atmosphere in which Du Bois was writing. Look how progressive he is for that moment. don't just view him from the sort of perfectionist standpoint of our present, but understand what an extraordinary blow he was striking for progress in his moment.
Yeah, that's true. But take Aristotle, who never recognized the full agency of women, who thought that women had different kinds of souls than men, who thought that women had souls that were fit to be governed because they didn't have fully developed reason, and men had souls that were fit to govern because at least certain men had fully developed reason. How do you contextualize that in a way?
And that's a case where I would say I don't think contextualization is sufficient. Right.
So what do you think, Julie?
Yeah, I mean, contextualization is probably not the answer to everything. I think with a writer like Conrad, where he's really taking up his historical present, contextualization is very helpful. Now, with the kind of text that you're bringing up, say Aristotle has actually been really important to a lot of feminists. And in a situation like that, what some writers do is they find these holes in the argument. They find places where the text is raising its own questions and not complete, if you will. And feminists have taken up that opportunity to find what in Aristotle can be transformed, not turning his words against him, but filling in the gaps of his own thinking and expanding it on the terms that he lays out.
And I think that's really important work. And I think, contextualization can get us somewhere with people like Du Bois, I think. But the kind of work you're talking about, filling in the holes, seeing possibilities, and even just sorting out the good from the bad. I mean, I think, if we want to keep reading these books, what we're doing at the end of the day is reading a set of books that are going to make us ambivalent. You talked about Conrad being a racist, anti-racist. I love that expression, right? These works are complicated. They're difficult. They refuse our desire to put them in a simple category.
But let me challenge both of you. Okay, I'm not sure what I believe about this. So I'm not playing devil's advocate, but I am offering a thought that will challenge you. Okay, there are critiques of colonialism, post-colonial critique, that are not racist, anti-racist, right? What does a student have to learn? What do we have to learn from the racist, anti-racist, rather than just from the flat-out anti-racist? Why bother? If we want a critique of colonialism, why bother? Why bother with Conrad? There are plenty post-colonial
Ngugi wa Thiong'o.
Fanon, that's what I'm thinking of. Mm-hmm. Fanon, why not just go straight to Fanon?
Well, it's interesting. In my book, I kind of get to Fanon by way of Conrad, but also the reverse. I get to Conrad by way of Fanon, and I argue that these two writers are, to some extent, completing each other. And with a writer like Conrad, what interests me about him was his kind of vexed desire for blackness, that if we don't understand the psychology of racism, we're not going to get very far. That there's something about getting inside the mind of a racist that is helpful towards the project of critique and of liberation. And Conrad, as someone who is conflicted, helps us to understand that racism is also about punishing this other that you desire. And I don't think there's a lot of texts that get at that complication of racism, that it's not just about hatred, it's about desire.
That makes a lot of sense. And I also think that there's just something to be said for asking people to grapple with ambivalence, right? Presenting with books that can't simply be categorized as just bad or good, yes or no, up or down, but where you have to say, gosh, we have to reject this part, but we really want to keep this other part. Yeah. And maybe there's a third part where you think that's a kind of symptom of something. This is hinting at something about the way racism works. And so there's just so much to be gained as long as we're properly critical and we don't just think Conrad knows the truth about everything and we have to just swallow it. If we're properly critical and can handle our ambivalence, we're getting something really powerful out of it.
You're listening to Philosophy Talk. We're reading The Troubled Past. But I'm still not quite sure. Here's something else Julie said. I wonder if you think this is important. You said something about, we come out of this past. So I say to students, look, if we're not willing to interrogate the past, then we're not willing to interrogate ourselves because the roots of ourselves. So here's the thing I wonder about Conrad. I mean, what would you expect the first critique How would you expect a European critique of colonialism to arise? It would be a disenchanted European, but a European of that time would not see the full agency of the Africans who had been colonized by the Europeans. So is it surprising? No, it's not surprising, but it's interesting that even in Europe, among the Europeans, there could be this falling out with colonialism. What do you think about that thought?
Yeah, absolutely. And that's what interests me about Conrad, is that his Europeanism and whiteness were vexed things, and that in part his writing of this kind of mythology or fantasy of the African was one of the ways that he was achieving his whiteness. And we think of whiteness as this thing that's given in advance, but it has to be won, it has to be secured. And there is something about Conrad that in that moment, he is the disenchanted European, but he's also riding through this fantasy of blackness in order to secure his own European identity. That's what's interesting.
So let
me
ask you another question along that lines then. Okay, so here's a critique that one often hears of the so-called canon, that you have to judge it by the voices that are missing, right? There are so many missing voices. So because the European who falls out with colonialism still doesn't see the agency of the African. Mm-hmm. What's the point? What's the point of reading this stuff in which my agency as a black person, your agency as a woman, is just not recognized, is not fully recognized? What's the point of my reading this now? Mm-hmm. I mean, okay, maybe there was a point a long time ago, but there is no point now. So what's the enduring point of reading the canon?
Well, I think I would take issue with that there is no point now, as if these struggles are over. So transformations aren't complete. They're slow coming. They're hard won. And what interests me about a novel like Heart of Darkness is that the narrator, he begins as one man and he ends as another. His change of mind is not this grand epiphany. And I think that changes of mind are rarely a grand epiphany. It's about this kind of slow transformation where you realize you're on the other side of something and you can't go back to the way you thought before. And so what are the limits and the possibilities of change? And, you know, these struggles are not over. So a text like that is a great opportunity to think about those limits and possibilities.
I like that idea, you know, and it makes me think of something I'm a little more tentative about. But, you know, but I sometimes think about the books we're writing now, you know, where I think we like to think of the books we're writing now as morally perfect. Like, we've overcome.
Really?
Well, some people do. Right? Yeah. Let's just read the works from today. And of course, we've made a lot of moral progress. But, you know, most of the novels you're going to read today take for granted that eating meat is okay, or, you know, at least not heinous. But it might be that in 50 years or 100 years from now, we look back at meat eating the way we currently look back at smoking, you know, as something that's bad for you and just bad, morally wrong. So it makes me wonder, you know, will there ever be such a thing as a morally pure a book of philosophy, a morally pure work of fiction? And if we have...
I wrote the morally pure book of philosophy just last year.
Yeah, that was really good. You know, so I wonder whether maybe we're making a mistake if we say, look, you know, we should just never read Conrad again. We should never think there's anything worthwhile in engaging, critically, of course, with Conrad, because if we do that, then we're basically saying, you know what? There's kind of no point, in a sense. Nothing's going to endure. Nothing is going to endure. Everything's going to be viewed 50 years from now, 100 years from now, as not being quite all the way there. And so maybe our willingness to sort of, you know, keep our history alive is a promise to the future. It's not just a gesture of the past. It's also a promise to the future. You know what? You make the best effort you possibly can in the moment, in the now, to write something as true as it can possibly be, as honest, as moral as it can possibly be. And, you know, we'll venerate you for the effort that you made.
What do you think, Julie?
Yeah, absolutely. I think that it's a dangerous path to expect that any work, as you say, be morally pure. And I'm not convinced that literature or even philosophy teaches us how to be. I was kind of with Ken when he said at the beginning that that the canon, if anything, is a repository of questions. And it's very hard to predict what the future is. And there's something that was kind of my point earlier, that these works are by nature incomplete, that they require others to take them up because we don't know what the future is, and we don't know by what standards the future will hold us in the present, by what standards we'll be held to, if that makes sense.
Yeah, it makes perfect sense. You're listening to Philosophy Talk. We're reading The Troubled Past, and we've got Doug from Oakland on the line. Welcome to Philosophy Talk, Doug. What's your comment or question?
Hello. Well, that last comment sort of, it was actually around the answer slightly the question I was going to ask, but I'm just interested in the way that somehow, like the idea of the perfectionist present, which she just kind of addressed. But actually, if there's some sort of almost an imperialistic sense of that, like imagine teaching these principles in another country, for instance, like, you know, saying that the West is somehow perfect if we're not race, you know what I mean? It's like that there is, you know, these are qualities that are going to be found in other places, and to impose that, think about imposing those values and the way that they have been imposed to kind of like, oh, democracy is so much better than any other system. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
We're not sexist, so we should go invade places that are sexist.
That kind of thing.
And also, just slightly to see Conrad also as a second language learner. You know, and mm-hmm. so, anyways, those are some issues that I'd be interested to hear from.
No,
I love your discussion.
Thanks a lot, Doug. I think all of us, would reject what I call the triumphalism of the present, the triumphalism of this moment. Because I do think that's part of what's going on in our rejection of the canon, the kind of triumphalist presentism. I don't know if you agree or not, Julie. Comment briefly on that.
Yeah, and I wanted to pick up on something that was in the Roving Philosophic Report, where one of the interviewees was saying that it's usually presumed that the audience or the generic human being is implicitly male. And we could also add implicitly white. And, you know, we can't presume a neutral universal audience for anything. You can't presume that your position is totally applicable everywhere and in all times. I don't want to open up a kind of can of worms of relativism, but I think that there is something to that of what the caller was saying about presuming that a mode of reading in one context should be the same in another context.
You're listening to Philosophy Talk. We're reading The Troubled Past with Julie Naplin, author of The Fact of Resonance.
If the canon is full of morally troubling books, should we revise it, expand it, or dump it in the trash?
Firing the cannon when Philosophy Talk continues. Is reading the Western canon like talking to a racist friend at a party? Is it time to talk to someone else? I'm Ken Taylor, and this is Philosophy Talk, the program that questions everything.
Except your intelligence. I'm Josh Landy. Our guest is Julie Naplin, author of The Fact of Resonance and former Better O'Rourke band member.
I think that's former Better O'Rourke bandmate.
I was on bass.
Oh.
Yeah.
And we've got a caller on the line, Kristen from Oakland. Welcome to Philosophy Talk, Kristen.
Oh,
what's your comment or question?
Hello. In your discussion, I've not heard any mention of the intrinsic artistry of these works, the beauty of the words, the beauty of the language, the art itself, which I think is separate from the political content. You don't throw them on the trash heap because you don't agree currently with the political content of it. These works have a body and life separate from the political content. What about the beauty? What about the art?
What do you think about that, Julie? I have complicated thoughts. What are your thoughts about that?
Mm-hmm. Well, you know, in Chinua Achebe's essay, he makes the point that he disagrees with seeing Conrad as a work of beauty or as a work of so-called great literature because of what he felt was its ugliness. And that its content for him overcomes its form. And I don't think that works should be read for their beauty alone. That isn't a position that I hold, but I do happen to think that Conrad is an incredibly beautiful writer. But I don't think that form and content are separate. I don't think that something can just be beautiful without its content also taking up something that has magnitude.
Well, we may disagree there, actually. I'm super grateful to Kristen for that call. It's really getting a really interesting dimension in here. Look, take Leni Riefenstahl's movie, The Triumph of the Will, a famous work of Nazi propaganda. What I want to say about that is, if that movie hadn't been so aesthetically powerful, it wouldn't have been so dangerous. You know, mm-hmm. So I think there can be morally troubling works that have beauty, and that's actually what makes them, in a way, worse. It makes them more dangerous.
Yeah, but I don't know. I don't know. There is the power of the work to move you. I'm going to call it aesthetically. I'm not quite sure that's the right word, but that is not separate, entirely separate. Look, a movie that I despise and I think should never be shown again, but some people think is a work of great American cinema.
Gone with the Wind.
Is Gone with the Wind.
It's a
I despise
terrible film.
That. Well, but not everybody agrees with you about that, right? It's played and replayed and all this sort of stuff. It's a morally bankrupt lie. I don't think I can separate I know these people knew how to do the arts of cinematography. They knew how to tell a story that was moving and gripping, right? They knew how to create a character, but it was in service of an utter lie. So what do we make of art like
okay,
that?
Okay, but maybe we can take, you know, we can dial down the volume a little bit, take slightly less vexed cases, right? You take, so, you know, go back to something, well, Aristotle's obviously philosophy, but you know, Dickens, the stuff that that Holly J. McDeed, our roving philosophical reporter, was talking about. Take some work of fiction that we think rightly has powerful aesthetic merits. Well, what if it has one or two moments that are mildly troubling, as opposed to Gone with the Wind, which is just thoroughly saturated?
Right.
I would want to say with Kristen, you know what, we should keep those works around. We should venerate them. Of course, we should warn people about the one or two moments that are morally
problematic. What do you think?
But
Julie?
We can make them safe for us.
What do you think, Julie?
Well, I do want to point out something that was happening earlier in the argument, which is that we quickly went to film as a different example. And I would point out that the literary work of art is not the same as the cinematic work of art, and
true.
That aesthetically talking about words and talking about images, these are different things. So we have to approach them with different tools. I just want to flag that. But yes, I would agree with Josh that works that have troubling moments, those moments shouldn't be forgotten. And in some cases, I think that they can be magnified and that a lot can be done with that magnification. The first chapter of my book is actually 100 pages about two words in Conrad's first novel.
Fair enough. But I guess my caution is let's not go overboard. I mean, I think about Ralph Ellison's novel, Invisible Man. I think it's an incredible novel about race, and it's an incredible novel about identity, and it's doing amazing things with the form of the novel. And okay, it's a little bit weak on gender, but I don't think we should throw it out.
That's different. That's the moment. So it's a complicated moral landscape. But we've got another caller on the line. Pam from San Francisco. What's your comment or question?
I was thinking, I grew up with grandparents who were very well versed in the canon and admiring that and thinking that was I should be, and then realized later that I shouldn't be, didn't want to be, as completely as that. But I wanted to comment about another thing, which is that I read Jack Kerouac 3 times. I read On the Road 3 times, and I read it the first time identifying with the men, which is what I did from the age that I could begin to read. I identified with the men because they had the interesting roles. I read it a second time, and I hated it, every minute of it. Now, I know he's not the canon, but I want to tell you this story. And I hated every minute of it for the sexist behavior and attitudes. And then I read it a third time, and I said, yes, but look, he's talking about things that no one was writing about, and he was able to write about them, and it was quite liberating. And I felt the same way about Henry Miller. I felt the same way about Kurt Vonnegut, you know, and in fact, I grew up in Indiana, and I admired Kurt Vonnegut for being able to say many of the things he said while growing up in Indiana, which he was a person whose parents knew my grandparents, and I really understood where he was coming from, and I just feel that Conrad, all these people that I talked about were writing about things that no one had really written about, and they are valuable for that. And we're talking about, well, should we teach it in the canon? Should we teach it in college? Well, maybe. I don't know.
So,
maybe people are only going to read 10 books in their life, and that's got. We want that to be one of them.
So
but,
you're,
you know, having read hundreds and hundreds of books in my life, I think I want to read all of it.
So, Pam, your bottom line is there's deep ambivalence. Read, maybe not, maybe not. So what do you think? Thanks for the call. What do you think, Julie? What there's deep ambivalence there about this canon thing. Grew up with parents who loved it. Fell away from it, came back to it.
Yeah, I mean, what I loved about what Pam was saying is that she described a situation of transformation and something that is not static. And in a recent essay in The Times by Ngugi Wa Thiong'o on Conrad, he basically tells a similar story, like, I turned away from Conrad, then I turned back towards him, then I turned away again, now I'm back. And a critic who I like a lot, Roland Barthes, he has this notion of the work versus the text. The work tends to be closed in some ways, but there's something about a text, and I think what she's saying about Kerouac is that it's a text, is that it's open, it's not static, it's changing.
You're right. I think that's right. I want to bring up one other thing, then I want to ask you a closing thought question. So look, I have been recently teaching Simone de Beauvoir a lot, and she has this thing about our attitude toward the past. She calls it the aesthetic attitude. And she says about the aesthetic, she says about the past, it's a museum of human projects. And what we're called upon to do with the past is judge it, but not relive it, right? The past, she says, now if we had the aesthetic attitude toward the present, that would be bad, because the present is the moment. Now is the time of decision and commitment. Now is the time to move the project forward. But I look back at the Romans, and there's no project that they're saying, take sides in this project. Side with Caesar over the Visigoths or whatever, right? I just get to judge it. I don't have to live it. So why can't we just the museum of the human past is something there to be interrogated. It's something there to be probed, to be judged, to be rejudged, to be seen in this or that light. So why should we be so upset that it's a morally different universe? It's a museum. It's dead, right?
Well, someone like Faulkner would say that the past is not dead. And this, I would take issue and say that the dividing line between the past and the present is actually really hazy.
I agree.
And when
with
you read
that.
Someone like Faulkner, it's happening in the 30s, but you're like, my God, this could be now.
I agree about that. And that's the thing that Simone de Beauvoir doesn't ask. Where does the moment of decision and commitment begin, and where does the dead past end? She's not very clear.
But
about
in a it. Way, precisely because of that, it's another reason to read these texts, because so much of our current ways of thinking, so much of our practices, even if you think about the way that, you know, Toni Morrison in her novels draws on the classics, think about the Odyssey showing up in Song of Solomon. So I love your point, Julie, that the past isn't dead. The past in the present. I think that's another actually good reason to be informing ourselves.
Well,
about
that's
that
a
past.
Complicated question, but let's ask you one last thought. We're going to make you ruler of the university education around the world. You can either chuck the canon, revise the canon, expand the canon. What do you do?
I say revise the canon, update it, and expand it. Can I give you an example?
Yeah,
sure.
This came to mind earlier when Ken was talking about Du Bois, and I was thinking about how the name Hegel never comes up in The Souls of Black Folk, but a lot of what Du Bois is doing in The Souls of Black Folk is revising, updating, and expanding Hegel. And he's saying that Hegel denied history, the status of history to African peoples. And Du Bois says, I'm going to show how African peoples and peoples descended from Africans have a world historical status. And he needed Hegel's system of dialectics to show what was so devastating about the consequences of racism on a psychological level of consciousness. So I think teaching Du Bois with Hegel is a perfect example of this revision of the canon.
I totally agree. And you could also teach Du Bois with the, I guess, left or right Hegelians, because he's a vanguardist just like them. But, you know, on that note, Julie, this has been a fascinating, a canonically fascinating conversation. And I'm going to thank you for joining us. It's been great having you back.
Thank you so much, guys. It was great to talk to you.
Our guest has been Julie Naflin. She's a professor of digital humanities. She's author of a forthcoming book entitled The Fact of Resonance, Modernist Acoustics and Narrative Form. So, Josh, what are you thinking now? Are you having resonant thoughts?
Oh, very resonant. Listen, I think about F. Scott Fitzgerald saying that the test of a first-rate intelligence is the ability to hold two opposed ideas in the mind at the same time and still retain the ability to function. I think reading these old books is an exercise in handling ambivalence. And I think there is a good way to read them. You know, we don't read them for answers. Read them for questions. Read them for habits of mind. Read them for models of beauty, as Kristen was saying. And yeah, read them to live in ambivalence and be able to function.
Yeah, there you go. I totally agree with you. The conversation continues at Philosopher's Corner at our online community of thinkers, where our motto is, with apologies to that dead white man Descartes, cogito ergo blogo, I think, therefore I blog. And you can become a partner in that community by visiting our website, philosophytalk.org.
And if you have a question that wasn't addressed in today's show, we'd love to hear from you. Send it to us at comments@philosophytalk.org, and we may feature it on our blog. Now here's someone who reads his past at troubling speed. It's Ian Scholes, the 60-second philosopher.
Ian Scholes, much is made of the politically correct culture on campus. Young people are triggered by depictions of rape, by smoking on stage, loud music, sexist cussing, or seeing the N-word in print. Fainting and lawsuits prevail. It's raised havoc. No more Huckleberry Finn, Joseph Conrad, Kipling, no more screenings of Birth of a Nation, The Jazz Singer, or every 30s musical that featured a blackface number, which was roughly most of them. Black people were not alone in being the brunt of prejudice. Swedes, Jews, comic Irishmen, Germans, Chinese, on and on. Fresh off the boat, talking funny, smelling like herring, wearing weird shoes for the amusement of the audience, which also conformed to some kind of weird ideal. I imagine the ideal American 1930s audience looking a lot like Tucker Carlson, whose day job was writing snarky headlines for the newly launched Time magazine. Now, today it's more white students than black, it seems, having fainting spells, encountering our racist past, which is odd, because the arguments for Conrad and Twain and whoever come mainly from white conservatives, who not only think we've come a long way racism-wise, racism doesn't even exist. So why get upset about the past anymore? It's such a quaint artifact. I just read an opinion in the Wall Street Journal by Joseph Epstein, who wrote, quote, racism is what you accuse people of who don't agree with you, unquote. He says we don't have Jim Crow and race riots and Pinkertons and lynching and torching homes, so anytime the Reverend Al Sharpton, the go-to guy for conservatives in this issue, I guess because of the whole Tawana Brawley thing, or which happened back in 1987, speaking of things that are over, anytime Al Sharpton calls racist, it rakes the old leaves up, and it's so unfair, you guys. And you can't say it's unfair, because that just gets called another form of racism. Epstein concludes, quote, the real racists in this country are those who insist blacks are permanent victims, unquote. The real racists. Hard to find, but all around, so long as you look at black people and not white conservatives, who are always on the lookout for anti-racism that is actually racist somehow. The anti-racist racist backlash is everywhere. TV's Laura Ingraham, for instance, did a segment on our race obsession, as she put it, with Harry and Meghan's royal baby. See, Laura Ingraham doesn't doubt racism exists. She just thinks Obama's responsible for not ending it within his first 100 days. Laura Ingraham has been accused of dropping the dog whistle and picking up the megaphone, and I know just what that means. When I was in college, I worked as a janitor at a black bar. One day, a new bar opened in town, and all the brothers who worked at or frequented the black bar were infuriated. Why? The new bar had a racist admittance policy. No hats allowed. Oh, wait, I asked, though I should have kept my trap shut. How is that racist? Because I was told black people like to wear hats, and I realized it was true. This was a hat-filled period in casual black fashion because of Marvin Gaye, Curtis Mayfield, and that boss chapeau Ron O'Neill wore in Superfly. And this is the first I realized there was such a thing as a dog whistle, the opposite of virtue signaling. Letting people know you're a racist without admitting you're a racist, seeing how much you can get away with before a fight breaks out. And then you can blame the other guy for starting it. So, blatant racism of the past is shunned. We now have veiled racism. Racially charged barbs and tweets with feedback. We play the race card. Or not. Discuss. We got innuendo, secret gestures, coded language, race baiting. In this age of Me Too and rampant triggering, it all seems so insidious. How much more innocent racism used to be? It was just lynching and minstrel shows. Are we better off? Instead of the Ku Klux Klan rioting, we have solitary psychos with semi-automatic weapons. Nobody reads anymore, so you don't need to worry about racist rants and chat rooms. It's the content of character, not the color of skin, say the old white poots who think they still run things. And now we're talking about reparations. I ask you, ask conservatives, how is that not racist who chide black people for wanting compensation for years of oppression? Ipso facto, none dare call it back pay. So the real racist is, therefore, of course, Oprah Winfrey, because Al Sharpton, right? Well, no, not to be racist about it, but to be racist, you gotta be white. Sorry. Like Tucker Carlson, like Donald Trump. Just asking. I gotta go.
Philosophy Talk is a presentation of KALW, Local Public Radio, San Francisco, and the trustees of Leland Stanford Junior University, copyright 2019.
Our executive producers are David Demarest and Tina Pamantuan.
The senior producer is Devin Strolovich. Laura McGuire is our director of research. Cindy Prince-Baum is our director of marketing.
Thanks also to Merle Kessler, Angela Johnston, and Lauren Schechter.
Support for Philosophy Talk comes from Stanford University and from the partners at our online community of thinkers.
The views expressed or misexpressed on this program do not necessarily represent the opinions of Stanford University or of our other funders.
Not even when they're true and reasonable.
The conversation continues on our website, philosophytalk.org, where you too can become a partner in our community of thinkers. I'm Josh Landy.
And I'm Ken Taylor. Thank you for listening.
And thank you for thinking.
The offing was barred by a black bank of clouds, and the tranquil waterway leading to the uttermost ends of the earth flowed somber under an overcast sky, seemed to lead into the heart of an immense darkness.